Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Working Stiff by Annalise Ryan. Narrated by Georgina Marie.
Chapter 1. I'm surprised by how much the inside of a dead body smells like the inside of a live one. I expected something a little more tainted, like the difference between freshly ground hamburger and that gray one day away from the dumpster stuff you get in the discount section at the grocery store. Of course, all I've seen so far is the freshly dead, not the deadly dead. Apparently, the deadly dead can invade your nostrils with molecules of nasty-smelling stuff that clings and burns and threatens to make you vomit for days afterward. Or, so says Izzy, and he should know since cutting up dead people is what he does for a living. And now, so do I. It's only my second day at it, but I can already tell it's going to be a real conversation stopper at cocktail parties. At the moment, we are standing on opposite sides of an autopsy table with a woman's body laid out between us, her torso looking as if it's just been filleted. I'm sure we create a strange tableau, and not just because of the open corpse. Izzy and I are the yin and yang of body types, Munchkin and the Amazon. The only thing we have in common is a tendency to put on the pounds. Izzy is nearly as wide as he is tall, and I'm cursed, or blessed, depending on your perspective and what century you were born in, with the perfect metabolism for surviving long periods of hunger. My body is a model of energy efficiency, burning calories the way a miser on a pension burns candles. But that's where our commonalities end. Izzy is barely 5 feet tall, while I hit the 6 foot mark at the age of 16, although I tell anyone who asks that I'm 5'12". Izzy has a dark Mediterranean look while I'm very fair, white blonde hair, blue eyes, and a pale complexion, though not nearly as pale as the woman on our table. Izzy reaches over, hands me the woman's liver, and asks, "So, what do you think so far?" He sounds a little concerned, which isn't surprising. This job takes a bit more getting used to than most. Think? I'm trying not to think. I place the liver on the scale beside me and record the result on my clipboard. "Oh, come on. When you get right down to it, is this really all that different from what you were doing before?" Yeah, I answer in my best duh tone. "How so? You used to cut people open. You handled their insides. You saw blood and guts. It's pretty much the same, no?" "Hardly. Though it's been a mere 2 months since I traded in the starched white lab coat from Mercy Hospital that had my name, Maddie Winston, R.N., embroidered across the pocket. At the moment, it feels like an eternity ago. This is nothing like my work in the O.R. There, the patient's bodies were always hidden behind sterile drapes and waterproof shields, the field of focus nothing more than an iodine bronze square of skin and whatever lay directly beneath it. Most of the time, I never even saw a face. But this, not just a face, but the entire body, naked, ugly, and dead. And there's no poor man's tan here. These people are the color of death from head to toe. It's a bit of a mental adjustment. After 12 years of working to save people's lives, I now remove their innards after they're dead and weigh them on a scale like fruit. Not exactly a move up the career ladder. "Well, for one thing," I tell Izzy, "my clientele used to be alive." "Live schmive," he says, handing me a spleen. "With all that anesthesia, they might as well have been dead. They didn't talk to you, did they?" "Well, no, but..." "So it's really no different, is it? Here, hold this back." He directs my hand toward a pile of lower intestine and sets about severing the last few connections. "I don't think it's this job that's bothering you. I think you miss Dr. Wonderful." Dr. Wonderful is Dr. David Winston, who is not only chief of surgery at Mercy Hospital, but also my husband. At least until I get the divorce papers filed. "You do miss him, don't you?" Izzy persists. "No, I don't." "Not even the sex?" "There's more to life than sex." I utter this with great nonchalance, despite the fact that Izzy has hit a sore spot. During the last few months of my marriage, sex ranked just below plucking my eyebrows and cleaning out the toilet bowl on my list of things to do. Now that I no longer have the option, unless I want to don some stilettos and a tube top and cruise the streets, my libido seems to be growing by leaps and bounds. Izzy shakes his head in wonder as he hands me a kidney. "See, that's the difference between men and women. Men? We always miss the sex. Good, I say bitterly. I hope David is missing it like crazy.
It doesn't look like he's missing it at all.
My heart does a funny beat, almost as if it's echoing the uh-oh that I'm thinking. I look over at Izzy, but he's studiously avoiding any eye contact. What the hell is that supposed to mean? He sighs and shakes his head. Do you know something, Izzy? If you do, spit it out.
You mean you haven't seen the woman who's been coming over to David's house the past few nights?
His quick correction stings, but not as much as his information does. I've been consoling myself ever since the split up with an image of David pining away from me. Regretful, sad, and lonely. The only communication we've had since I left is one long, rambling, remorseful note in which David apologized exactly 9 times and swore his undying devotion to me. Izzy's suggestion that my side of the marital bed had barely grown cold before someone else moved in to heat it up, and I have a pretty good idea who that someone else is, brings tears to my eyes. No, I haven't seen any woman, I tell him, struggling for a tone of casual indifference. But that's because I haven't looked. It doesn't matter anymore. I don't care what or who David does anymore.
Oh, okay.
I can tell from Izzy's tone that he isn't buying it, but I'm determined not to ask him what I'm dying to know. We begin taking sections from the organs we've removed, Izzy doing the slicing and dicing, me placing the carved pieces into specimen bottles as an awkward silence stretches between us. As soon as we are finished with each organ, I place it back inside the body cavity. After several minutes of this, I finally cave in. All right, you win. Tell me. Was it her? He shrugs.
I've never met her. What does she look like?
His question hurls me back some 2 months in time, and the memory, as always, triggers a flush of humiliation. Back then, David and I both worked in the OR at the local hospital. Despite working in the same place, we rarely did cases together, agreeing that it was wise to try to separate our professional lives from our private ones, so the dynamics of one wouldn't interfere with the intimacy of the other. That's the story I bought into, anyway. Though since then, I've wondered if David's motivation was something else entirely. Things came to a head on a day when David had a heavy load of regular surgeries, coupled with several emergency cases. He called late in the evening to say he still had one more case to do, and that he planned to crash at the hospital for the night. It was something he'd done before, usually because he had an unstable patient he was worried about, so it didn't raise any alarms with me. Knowing how much he hated hospital food, I threw together a goodie basket for him, some munchies for later that night, and some fruit and muffins for in the morning. I didn't call to tell him I was coming because I figured he'd already be in the middle of his surgery. Besides, I wanted to surprise him. He was surprised, all right, but not half as much as I was when I found the surgical area dark, quiet, and apparently deserted, except for a dim light emanating from a small operating room at the end of the hall. Inside the room, I found David with Karen Owenby, one of the other surgery nurses. David was leaning back against an OR table, his scrub pants down around his ankles, a look of ecstasy stamped on his face. Karen was kneeling in front of him, wholeheartedly vying for the title of head nurse. As the image sears its way across my brain for the millionth time, I squeeze my eyes closed in anger.
Is she really that ugly? Izzy asks, glancing at the expression on my face.
Uglier, I tell him. She has horns growing out of her head and snakes for hair. Izzy chuckles.
You know what you need?
For Richard Gere to fall madly in love with me and be my gigolo?
No, you need some excitement.
Apparently catching my husband taking his oral exam in the OR isn't excitement enough.
Yep, Izzy says with a decisive nod. You just need a little excitement. After all, isn't that what drew you to medicine? The life and death pace? The high emotional stakes? Drama?
We are done with our sampling and the woman's organs are all back in her body. Though, not in any kind of order. I stare at them a moment, thinking they vaguely resemble that package of stuff you find hidden behind the ass flap on a turkey. It's a definite offense to my surgical sensibilities, and I have to remind myself that it doesn't matter. The woman is dead. I think I've had quite enough drama for one lifetime, I tell him.
No way,
You're an adrenaline junkie. You thrive on excitement. That's why you liked working at the hospital.
He steps down from the stool he has to use in order to reach the table, kicks it toward the woman's head, and climbs up again. Then he positions his scalpel just above her right ear.
There's not really that much adrenaline in the OR, I argue. In fact, it's one of the tamer areas of medicine, orderly and controlled.
True, but you were never happy in the OR. The place where you were happy was the ER. You should have stayed there.
I like the OR just fine, I argue.
He responds with a look that tells me the alarm on his bullshit detector is screeching. And I have to admit, he's right. The OR was okay, but I loved working the ER. I loved the surprise of never knowing what might come through the door next. I loved working as part of a synchronized team, rushing against the clock in an effort to save a life that hung on the brink. I loved the people, the pace, and even the occasional messiness of it all. The only reason I'd left it for the OR was so I could be closer to David. Well, that and the infamous nipple incident.
Okay, I concede. Maybe I am a bit of an adrenaline junkie.
And like any junkie, if you don't get a fix from time to time, you get edgy and irritable.
I'm pretty sure that's PMS, Izzy.
So I have an idea, he says, ignoring my brilliant rejoinder. Having sliced across the top of the woman's head from one ear to the other, he now grabs the front edge of this incision and pulls the entire scalp forward, exposing the skull. It is shiny and white except for a large clot of blood that clings to the right temporal lobe. From the x-rays we did earlier, I know that beneath the clot we'll find pieces of broken bone and an indentation in the skull that's roughly the same size and shape as a hammer, the weapon her drunken, jealous husband used to kill her. Izzy pauses to snap a few pictures with the digital camera and then says, "Part of my job is determining the cause and manner of any suspicious deaths in the county, and only part of that is gleaned from the autopsy. There's also investigative work that needs to be done at the scene of the death and afterward." He sets the camera aside and folds his arms over his chest. "You know, your position here can go one of two ways. You can keep working as a morgue assistant, which is basically what you're doing now, or you can function as a deputy coroner, which combines morgue duties with investigative work. My last assistant had no training in forensics and no interest in learning it. He simply wanted to do his job and get out of here." "I can't imagine why," I mutter, eyeing the body before us. "But you have an analytical mind and a strong curiosity. With a little training, you'd make a great investigator. And frankly, I could use the help. I think you should give it a try. Go out with me a time or two and see what it's like."
"You make it sound like a date."
He scoffs. "Yeah, like you would know." I scowl at him. "Give me a break. It's only been 2 months." "And you've spent every minute of it hibernating in your cave."
"I'm healing."
"You're wallowing."
"I am not."
"No? Then tell me how many pints of Ben and Jerry's you've polished off in the past 2 weeks."
"Oh, sure. Make me measure in pints so the number will sound worse than it is."
"Okay," he says, arching one eyebrow at me. "Have it your way. Tell me how many gallons of Ben and Jerry's you've polished off in the past 2 weeks.
Bite me, Itzy.
There's one other thing Izzy and I have in common, a fondness for nicknames. Izzy's real name is Itzhak Rybarczewski, a mouthful of syllables that even the most nimble linguists tend to stumble over. Hence the nickname, though even that gives him trouble at times. Because of his size, there are some who insist on pronouncing it as Itzy, something that drives him up the wall. For me, the problem is just a general loathing of my real name. I don't know what the hell my mother was thinking when she chose it, and even she has never used it. All my life I've been Maddie. The only place where my real name can be found is on my birth certificate, and that's fine by me. Outside of my family, there are only a handful of people who know my real name, Izzy being one of them. Though I have to be careful. If I pick on his name too much, he might turn the tables on me. "I don't think I'd make a very good investigator," I tell him, hoping to divert his attention away from my insult. "Sure you would. You're natural. You're nosy as hell. Now there's a bullet item I can't wait to put on my resume."
"At least give it a try," he says with a sigh.
"But I don't know the first thing about crime scene investigation. Hell, I've only been doing this for 2 days."
"You'll learn.
just like you're learning here. Just like you learned when you started working in the OR. I'll send you to some seminars and training programs. You'll catch on. I think about what he's suggesting. We live in Sorensen, a small town in Wisconsin where the crime rate is low, longevity is high, and the obits frequently tell of octogenarians who die unexpectedly. Even with what might come in from surrounding areas, which is mostly villages and farmland, I can't imagine us getting that much business. After all, this is Wisconsin, the land of cheese, brown-eyed cows, apple-cheeked people, and old-fashioned values. The only reason we have a medical examiner in Sorensen is because Izzy happens to live here. And we are the biggest city within a 100-mile radius, which isn't saying much, given that our population is only 11,000. So how often is a suspicious death going to occur? Still, I'm about to argue the point one more time when Izzy says, "Please, will you just give it a try? For me." Damn. His pleading face reminds me of what a good friend he's been to me, especially lately. I owe him. Okay, you win. I'll give it a shot. "Excellent," he says, though perhaps a bad choice of words for our line of business. He wiggles his eyebrows at me and I have to stifle a laugh, though not at his corny joke. At 50-something, Izzy suffers from that woolly caterpillar thing that strikes so many men as they age. The hairs in his eyebrows are longer than many of those on his head, though there are a few in his ears and nose that look like they might catch up. Moments later, my humor is forgotten as I place Ingrid Swenson's brain on my scale. Chapter 2. I'm sitting in the small cottage I call home, reflecting on day number 2 of my new job. Invariably, my thoughts drift to David, and I wonder if Karen Owenby is the woman Izzy saw visiting him. The mere mention of her name fills my mind with murderous thoughts. Yet, as bitter as my feelings toward Karen are, they're nothing compared to what I feel toward David. His betrayal devastated me. After catching him in the act on that fateful night, I drove home, threw together some clothes, and fled the house so I wouldn't have to face him again. But I didn't know where to go. I briefly considered heading to my mother's house, but realized that would be a big mistake. My mother is a lifelong prognosticator of gloom and doom, a modern-day Nostradamus. 5 minutes with her can induce a severe case of depression in me even when I go into it on the highest of highs. And on the night in question, I was already as low as I cared to go. In addition to her role as the great depressor, Mom is also a professional hypochondriac. She's a full-fledged, card-carrying, many-times-honored member of the Disease of the Month Club, and revels in sharing her various aches, pains, and possible terminal diseases with David and me. She has a collection of medical reference books at home that the Harvard Medical School would envy, and getting a doctor into the family had been the pinnacle of her existence. I knew she'd never forgive me for letting David go. Nope. Mom was definitely out of the question. I then considered my sister, Desiree, who, after a childhood of sibling rivalry and creative tortures, has become my best friend. But Desi thinks of marriage as a sacred, inviolable institution. I feared she would try to convince me that mine was worth saving no matter how grim it had become, and that I just might cave under the pressure. Or worse, I might say something about her marriage that I'd later regret. Not that her marriage is in trouble. As far as I know, it's doing just fine. But I can't stand Desi's husband, Lucian. He's a lawyer, a good thing I think, since he's a walking, talking sexual harassment suit waiting to happen. Half the words coming out of his mouth sound like dialogue from a bad porn movie, and he's been known to pop a chubby over anything that has, as he so indelicately puts it, 2 pairs of lips. Then there's the matter of Desi's 2 kids. Ethan and Erica, who sometimes seem like the perfect poster children for birth control. Erica is 12, and if she isn't actually the devil's spawn, she does a damn good imitation. She's weathering the hormonal storm of adolescence and is as emotionally stable as a crack addict quitting cold turkey. Desi doesn't seem bothered by the wild outbursts, the sullen attitude, the constantly dyed hair, or the nose piercing. She says it's just a phase, though personally I think Erica is a byproduct of the curse-crazy old Mrs. Wilding cast on Desi, back when we were kids and Desi peed in the old woman's flower garden. Ethan, on the other hand, could be a sweet kid. Is a sweet kid, I suppose. He's 9 and still at an age where he's willing to hug and doesn't think he knows everything. But I can't get used to this fascination he has with bugs. Real ones. Live ones. When he sees a bug, he gets this wide-eyed, eager expression, almost like a hunger. And within seconds, he's on it. Every time I see the kid, he's got some kind of multi-legged crawly thing with him. Often is not on him. Desi thinks it's cute. I just think it's creepy. Having ruled out my family as safe havens, I turned to Izzy. We've been friends for more than a decade, and I knew I could trust him to be horridly honest, but non-judgmental, exactly what I needed. Plus, he and his partner Dom loved to dish dirt, and I had 2 candidates who were ripe for the picking. Dom, who is 12 years younger than Izzy and several inches taller, is auburn-haired, lily-white, and slender. His eyes, an unusually deep shade of blue rimmed with long, thick lashes that any woman would envy, are his most distinctive feature. He's a born actor, and prior to meeting Izzy, he tried his luck in both New York and Hollywood before giving up and heading back home to Wisconsin. Nowadays, he keeps house for Izzy and limits his acting forays to a local thespian group. Since Dom and Izzy are not only my friends, but also my neighbors, it took me all of 2 minutes to throw my suitcases into my car and drive to their place, twice as long as it would have taken me to walk over. Dom answered the door, took one look at my tear-stained face, and ushered me into the kitchen. He shoved a box of tissues in front of me, hollered for Izzy, and then busied himself making tea. Izzy walked into the room, looked at me, and said, "Uh-oh, what's the jerk done?"
"The worst possible thing,"
I sobbed. Dom turned around from the stove, slapped a hand to his cheek, and looked aghast. "Oh no, you mean he wore plaid with stripes again?" I laughed despite my misery.
"No, it's much worse than that. He had sex with someone else."
"That bastard," said Dom.
"Are you sure?" said Izzy.
"Oh yes," I said, wincing. "I'm quite sure. I caught him in the act."
"What a fool," Izzy said, and for a brief moment I was flattered by the thought that Izzy considered me enough of a catch that David had to be an idiot to look elsewhere. But then he added,
"How stupid is it to do it right in your own house?"
"It wasn't in the house," I said,
pausing to inhale some steam from the tea Dom set in front of me.
"It was at the hospital, in one of the operating rooms."
"Ew," Dom said, making a face.
"Aren't those supposed to be sterile?"
"Supposed to be," said Izzy. "But you'd be surprised what goes on there. A few years ago, I heard about a doc who was caught trying to use a suction machine to..."
"Hey, guys," I interrupted. "Can we get back to the subject at hand, please?" Dom jumped in with, "It was a hand job?"
"No," I said, giggling. "It was a blow job."
"Oh, well, that changes everything," Izzy said. "Blowjobs haven't been considered sex since the Clinton administration."
For the next hour and a half, I sat at their kitchen table, alternately sobbing, laughing, whining, and listening as Izzy and Dom called David any number of nasty names and cast a host of colorful curses on his wandering one-eyed trouser snake. By the time they got around to declaring Karen a whoring bitch and me a selfless heroine horribly wronged, it began to feel like one of those religious revival sessions. Several times I was tempted to holler out, "Amen," at the end of a particularly rousing criticism or curse. The fun didn't last long, though. The hard reality of my situation kept creeping back into the forefront of my thoughts. That and the ominous silence of Izzy's phone. In my mind, I kept imagining David frantic with worry once he realized I wasn't home. I felt certain he'd be desperate to find me, to try to explain himself, or maybe even apologize. And I figured it wouldn't take him long to figure out where I was. He knew Izzy and I were close friends, so I was pretty certain that once he determined I wasn't with my mother or my sister, he'd check Izzy's place. But he didn't.
There was no knock on the door, no ringing of the phone. And when I finally gave in and called my mother to tell her not to worry, I discovered David hadn't called there either. Curious, I called home, and when David answered, I quickly hung up, stung by the truth of my situation. He was there. He knew I was gone, and yet he'd done nothing to try to find me or talk to me. That hurt almost worse than his infidelity. Everything I had come to believe about my relationship with him, about my life and my marriage, was a lie. And I still had no place to go. That's when Izzy came to the rescue. There was a cottage behind his house that he'd had built a few years ago for his mother, Sylvie. At the age of 80-something, Sylvie's health had taken a turn, and Izzy didn't want her living alone. But she was none too keen on living with her son as long as Dom was around. While Sylvie is well aware of Izzy's lifestyle, she isn't particularly happy about it. The mere sight of Dom always makes her clutch at her chest and let forth with a melodramatic, "Oi!" Living with Dom would probably trigger a rapid battery of oys that would either kill Sylvie or make Izzy want to. So Izzy compromised by building the cottage and hiring home nurses. After a year there, Sylvie's health improved and she moved into a retirement village where she's still oying strong. I'm sure she'll die unexpectedly at the age of 100 and something. Sylvie's defection meant the cottage was empty, furnished, and available. Given my circumstances, it would have been foolish of me to refuse Izzy's offer to let me stay there. Of course, the tiny detail that the cottage is a mere stone's throw from my own house is something I chose to ignore. Besides, it isn't as if I'm right next door. We live in a swanky neighborhood where most of the houses sell for half a mil or more, and the wooded lots are big enough to erect a good-sized parking lot. All I can see of my house from the cottage is a small section of the roof. The cottage was meant to be a temporary way station, though so far temporary had lasted a little over 2 months. 67 days of hiding away and wallowing on my pity pot. And despite what Izzy thinks, I have a very good reason for hiding. Small towns aren't particularly conducive to privacy. Fart with your windows open and the news will likely make it across town faster than the wind can carry the smell. Sorensen is no exception. And given that several people witnessed my hysterical flight from the OR with David chasing after me as he struggled to do up his pants, I have little doubt that most of the townsfolk know every sordid detail. I finally surfaced from my self-imposed exile a few days ago, and that was because I had to. I'm broke. The pitiful severance pay I had the hospital mail to Izzy's address, 4 weeks of accrued vacation time that I used as notice so I wouldn't have to show my face at work again, is almost gone. I've spent the bulk of it on essential food items like chocolate and cheesecake, though a few bucks, as Izzy well knows, have gone toward counseling from my two favorite therapists, Ben and Jerry. And another month of rent is due soon, not that Izzy would toss me out if I didn't pay. Hell, he's willing to let me stay in the cottage indefinitely for free. But pride is about the only thing I have left at this point, and warped as it is, setting up house in a Frigidaire box seems preferable to taking a handout. I'm just as determined to avoid asking David for help. Our checking account is a joint one, and the checkbook is in David's desk at home. All of the credit cards are in his name, too. And while I don't think David is mean enough to freeze all the accounts, I can't be certain. And I sure as hell don't want to risk further humiliation by going to the bank to find out. Besides, trying to sneak a few measly bucks here and there isn't my style. I want to earn my money fair and square, and with my pride intact, by nailing David's ass to the wall in a highly messy divorce proceeding. Once again, it was Izzy who saved the day, this time by offering me the job as his assistant. While the actual work it entailed did give me pause, I knew I couldn't afford to be picky. When I tried to think about non-medical jobs, I had enough training for. The only thing I came up with was prostitution. And then I realized that, in one way, the clientele at this new job were perfect. They were probably the only people in town who didn't know the sordid saga of David and me. So, thanks to Izzy, I have a new job and a new home. I have a chance to start over and leave a painful past behind. And as I sit here looking out the window at the distant flash of headlights from a car pulling into David's driveway, I tell myself I don't really give a rat's ass who might be visiting. But I do. It's perverse and stupid and destined to cause me pain.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?